after I got off the phone. I thought of this response and I felt wounded. Was this how she saw us? Some difficult, O'Neill-like family she had to shield her boyfriend from? As we walked the dogs later, I told Daniel about it. He disagreed with my interpretation.
She's just feeling what I was. That the two of them closed in together for a long weekend is a recipe for trouble. It doesn't have to be. No, but it often is. You'll help me, won't you, Daniel?
I must have sounded lonely or frightened him because he stopped me on the dark sidewalk and kissed my cheek. Actually, because it was so dark, pitch dark, as we were on a side street away from even the feeble lanterns around the green, he missed and got my ear. We swayed together a moment. When we turned to walk again, he kept his arm around me. Lights were off in most of the houses we passed. It was nearly 11. The town was silent, but for the odd barking of a dog. When we walked by the middle of the three Georgian houses facing the green, we looked over as one to the glowing windows of its front parlor. The room was empty. The lamplight fell on an empty chair. We turned away. A little breeze lifted my hair, brought us a smell of dry leaves of pine. "This is so perfect," I said. "This weather." I sighed. "This is why we live in New England." The next morning, it was snowing wetly, big plops smeared against the windows. When I opened the kitchen door, the raw, damp air blew in and the dogs milled around behind me with their tails down. "Get," I said. They cast tragic glances back at me as I shut the door on them. "Did you know about this?" I asked Daniel when he came in for coffee. He was a weather fanatic, a holdover from his youth on the farm. There, weather told you what you'd be doing on any given day.
I did.
And you let me be romantic about our fall night. You laughed up your sleeve at me.
He shrugged.
That's just the perfidious kind of guy I am.
I'll say. The drops gathered into clear slush at the sides of my windshield as I drove to work. The wet glistened on the road. Feeling sleepy, I stopped off at the bagel place to pick up some coffee.
"How do you like Mother Nature's joke?"
the owner asked me energetically. Malcolm. He ran the place single-handedly.
"She can stuff it," I said. "Joey, Joey," he scolded, grinning. He shook his head as he rang me up.
Though normally she worked just Monday, Wednesday, and Saturday, Mary Ellen was in today. She wanted Saturday off this week for her son's birthday party. It was sometimes crowded moving around in the hallway with all the dogs and people. Late in the morning, Beatty came back to my exam room.
"Your old boyfriend called," she said. Her lips were pinched disapprovingly.
"He's not my boyfriend, Beatty."
"Didn't say he was. I said your old boyfriend."
"He wasn't ever my boyfriend."
"Well, he called. He's coming in this afternoon," she sniffed.
"To put the dog down?"
"Yep."
She stood for a moment watching me, waiting for some response. She cleared her throat.
"I asked myself, you know, what I would do. I wouldn't do that."
"Beatty," I said, suddenly irritated, "you don't even have any animals." She turned to go.
"Doesn't matter, does it?"
From the hall, she called back.
"I know what I know."
As I went to tell Mary Ellen I'd need her later for euthanasia, I was smiling at Beatty. These were famous lines of hers, spoken usually at exactly the moment when she did not know what she did not know. I was thinking, I'll tell Daniel. We had a store of her pronouncements. But then I realized where she'd come from to get to what she didn't know, and I told myself that the story was based in a kind of animosity to Eli Mayhew that seemed too complicated and preposterous to explain. The snow continued wetly through the day, sometimes lightning briefly, the sun nearly breaking through and graying the sparse flakes, then thickening again, closing the world up around us. Night had fallen by 4, a combination of the effect of the storm and the recent change from daylight savings time. The last two clients of the day had already called council. Mary Ellen and I went up front to where Beattie had the radio turned to the news. We all stood around listening and eating cookies that Mary Ellen had to buy at the bake sale for her daycare center. Finally, the announcer got to the weather. Snow was icing up now that the temperature was dropping. There'd already been a few fender benders in the evening commute. I looked outside. It was 4:30, and our three cars were the only ones left in the parking lot. Beattie worriedly announced that she thought maybe she ought to go home early. Mary Ellen and I assured her this was fine. And actually, I was glad. I hadn't wanted her around for Arthur's euthanasia. Not that I thought she'd say or do anything while Eli was there, but she might make me uncomfortable somehow afterward. I was just as happy not to have to think about her comments. We told her how we'd help her close out the office, and we all began to move easily and efficiently around each other, turning off machines, locking up medications, filing, cleaning. Then Beattie was standing behind her desk, adding layer upon layer of sweaters and outerwear, most of them baggy and vividly colored and knit by herself. As I headed back to set up for Arthur and Eli, I heard her call, "See you tomorrow," and I yelled, "Drive carefully." The bell on the door jangled as she closed it. After she left, it occurred to me that I didn't know whether we would dispose of Arthur's body or Eli would take it. When I was finished and back, I went to Beattie's station behind the front counter and turned on her computer. I called up Eli's file. There was usually a note as to the disposition of the body, and Beattie had made one here. Eli would take Arthur home. I went up to the start of the file, and there was the address, 11 Duxbury Court. Fancy, expensive, a newish development of what had been the wooded part of an old estate. Eli's home and Arthur's grave. I thought of the trails that had crisscrossed through the land before it was developed, of how, deep in the woods, you could see crumbling stone fences that had once marked off the open fields of old farms. Townspeople had used the estate for bird watching, for walking dogs, as we sometimes did, or just as a retreat, a nearby place to go that made them feel far away from the world. When the owner died and his family sold it to a developer, there were protests and outraged letters in the local paper. To no avail. Time marched on, and brought me, I thought, Eli Mayhew. I closed down the computer and went to my exam room to wait. Eli arrived just after 5:30. When I heard the bell jangle, I stepped into the hall and called out his name. He appeared around the corner with Arthur in his arms. He came slowly down the hall. He set the dog down on the table again. His face was grim and flat, and I realized by its absence now how much animation had livened it before. "How long does it take?" he asked. He was unwinding a long, elegant scarf from his neck. Snowdrops glistened on the shoulders of his jacket. "Just seconds, really. Some people prefer to stay, and other people say goodbye and wait outside. Whatever feels right to you."
"Jesus, nothing feels right about this. But I'm staying."
He wouldn't look at me, I noticed. His face seemed shut in anger or pain. I kept my voice gentle. "I need to tell you, then, that it may not be easy. It should be, and most of the time it is. They just go to sleep. But some dogs vocalize. Some lose bowel or bladder control. Some thrash around a bit. I think what it is that the feeling of the drug disturbs them."
"They cry," he said.
"Yes, howl for a few seconds." He turned sharply away.
"Jesus."
"Arthur most likely won't. I hope he doesn't. But I want you to be prepared if he does." There was a long silence in the room. Eli's hands. I noticed again how large they were, but with long, graceful fingers, stroked Arthur's shiny fur over and over. Finally, he He did look up at me to say,
I don't know how you do this.
I shrugged. Some vets won't. But that had always seemed the cruelest choice to me, when people needed it, to send them searching for someone who would do it, someone they and their animal didn't know.
But you choose to.
I don't like it, Eli.
No, he said. No, of course not.
We stood glumly for a minute. I was intensely aware of the bright pink syringe lying on my table. Do you want a minute alone to say goodbye? I asked. He shook his head. I said goodbye. He looked up at me, his eyes shiny. Let's do it, he said abruptly. I opened the door and called Mary Ellen. She came nearly instantly. She'd been waiting, too. I made the briefest of introductions, a gesture, really, and their names, and then I turned away to get the syringe while she reached for Arthur's front leg. You can hold him if you like, I said to Eli. When I turned back, I saw that he had bent over Arthur, his face buried in the dog's neck. He was speaking gently, saying what a good boy Arthur was, repeating this over and over. Arthur was making a soft, throaty noise of pleasure and poking at him with his muzzle. Mary Ellen nodded at me. She was ready. I came around her in front of Arthur, set my fingers beside the vein, and injected the needle. I pulled back slightly at the start, and the blood eased in. I had the vein. Quickly, I pushed the pink fluid in. Arthur had turned to me briefly at the stick, but then he relaxed, and within a few seconds he went limp and rolled slightly farther to his side. I heard Eli's sharp intake of breath. I had my fingers on Arthur's vein now. I had felt the throbbing slow and stop. Nothing. I nodded at Mary Ellen, and she left silently. Now I set my stethoscope on Arthur. After a few seconds, I said to Eli, "He's gone." Eli stood up. He was looking down at Arthur, who lay utterly relaxed on his side now, his eyes slightly open. Eli's eyes were red. His face was pulled into deep lines, nose to mouth, mouth to chin. My hands were trembling. "I'm sorry," I said. I reached out to touch his arm, feeling his unfamiliar solidity under the thick fabric of his jacket. His head swayed slightly on his neck as if in response, and I remembered suddenly the way he'd looked when I saw him in the police station after Dana died. "I know," he said and turned again to the dead dog. He left a few minutes later, carrying Arthur out into the heavy, wet snowfall in the box we provided. I stood at the door, watching him set the box down tenderly, watching him open the car and then load Arthur in. Mary Ellen was suddenly behind me, her hand on my shoulder. "You okay?" she said. I turned to her. She had her coat on and big purple boots. She would probably be late to pick up her son at daycare. Her broad, pretty face was tense behind her glasses. "I am." "It's never easy, is it?"
"No,"
she said. "Thanks for staying."
"You've done it for me," she said.
She pulled her hat on and some mittens. Nothing matched.
"Is he a friend?" she asked.
She was gesturing at the parking lot. Arthur and Eli were gone. "Kind of," I said. "Someone I knew way back when, who just moved here."
Beattie said something like that.
She pulled her shoulders square.
"Well," she announced, "I gotta go."
"Oh, I know,"
I said. "Go, go."
I waved her away.
"You're okay?"
"I really am," I said.
"Treat yourself when you get home," she said.
"Thanks, Mary Ellen," I said. And then I was alone. I moved around the office slowly, putting a few things away, wiping down my table. I left a note for Ned explaining that we'd left a little early. I got my coat on. The air outside was raw, and I was sorry I hadn't taken the time to get out winter clothes this morning. Gloves, anyway, or maybe a hat.
Had I not believed in the snow after yesterday's warm sunshine? It was still melting now as it landed, but the ground felt icy underfoot. I sat in the car and let it warm up, my breath a pale shadow in front of my face with each exhalation. The houses along the back roads home were lighted for the most part. Here and there you could see someone, usually a woman, moving around, or the bluish flicker of a TV. Daniel wouldn't be home yet. Our house would be dark. I pulled up to a red light at the intersection of Bishop's Pond Road. If I turned left instead of right here when the light changed to green, I would only have half a mile or so to get to Eli's house. I imagined the way it would look. Massive, many-windowed, many-terraced. I imagined Eli carrying the box that held Arthur.
"Do you have many of these?" Eli had asked.
"Hundreds by now, maybe 1,000. Always with a kind of breathlessness at the last moment. A fear of it, I suppose, a fear, of course, that it might not go well, that the animal might keen or howl as some did, or that the owner might be overwhelmed by grief. But mostly, just a kind of terror of the speed with which it happened once I gave the injection, of how quickly the line between life and death was crossed. I thought of that moment with Arthur, his utter relaxation into death within seconds. My hands on him as he went over. Eli there. And then I realized that the Eli who floated somewhere close by this image in my mind, the Eli who bent over his dog, was the young Eli. The Eli standing alone on the porch as I pulled away in a cab from the house on Lyman Street. Consciously, I tried to focus on the older Eli's face, and I could not quite get it. I realized that I was confusing him visually with an old friend of Daniel's from Divinity School, another big, slightly paunchy man, who had visited us occasionally over the years when he was on the East Coast. The light had changed, and I turned right for home. In the headlights, the snow thickened with a dizzying motion. I drove slowly, and after I pulled into our driveway and turned the lights off, I sat for a long time in the dark, watching the wet flakes swirl and thinking in a confused overlay of the house on Lyman Street and of putting Arthur down, so that it seemed to me nearly as though I'd done it then, in that world, in that other life.
Chapter 8. When I came into the kitchen 2 days before Thanksgiving, Daniel pointed to the dirty duffel bag, the banged-up guitar case by the back door, and said, "Cass." "Where is she?" I asked, still stupid from sleep. He raised his eyes and pointed his thumb at the ceiling, upstairs.
"Sleeping, I reckon."
"Did you hear her?" I asked.
"I heard something, but I thought it was just the dogs."
I poured coffee. "Damn it! Why does she do this? I have to go to work."
"I'll stay home. I just have calls and letters. I can do them here."
"Will you call me when she gets up, or have her call? Maybe I can weasel home early somehow, or for lunch or something."
"She'll understand. But it's so familiar." I pulled out a chair and sat down opposite him at the table.
"She doesn't say when she's coming, so I can't be here to welcome her. So she'll be hurt and I'll feel bad." I drank some coffee. "But also set up, da, 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 and off we go again."
"Don't get ahead of everything, Joey.
Maybe she's mellowed." He was smiling at me.
I looked out the window at the dooryard. No cars but our own.
"How'd she get here?" I wondered.
"Somebody must have dropped her off."
"What time do you think you heard her?"
"I didn't look. More night than morning, though."
Allie came and rested her head on my thigh.
"Good morning." I stroked her fur, absently pulled at a burr stuck in it.
"God, I wish I could stay. I'm so excited to see her. I wish I could stay. I wish I were you and you were me."
"Me too." "Then you could call all the members of the fundraising committee."
"And you could check the stool samples."
"And you could tell the roofer we'll have to pay him in installments."
"And you could catheterize Florence Dicey's cat."
He smiled at me.
horrible lives, aren't they? Interchangeably and profoundly horrible. I couldn't get away all day. When I arrived home late in the afternoon, Cass was in the tub. I could hear her singing upstairs over the faint rumble of running water. Daniel had left me a note on the kitchen table, saying he'd be back for dinner briefly at around 6, reporting that he and Cass had made chili, suggesting that maybe I could throw a salad together. The table was set for 3. The kitchen was neat. The dogs' bowls were full. The dogs themselves were circling me frantically, and now I stopped to pet each one and then release them into the dark night air. When I flicked the outside light on, it caught their rumps disappearing, the long, bushy tails swinging with pleasure as they plunged into the black thicket under the pine trees. I pried off my boots, hung up my coat, and then climbed the steep, painted stairs, pulling on the wooden handrail. Cass's duffel was open on the floor of her room now, and her clothes were sorted into several messy piles. The bed was made. I leaned against a noisy bathroom door and knocked. "Cass!" I yelled. "Cassie, it's Mom!" The water stopped.
"Mom?"
"Yes, I'm home."
3 secs, 2. I'll be right down."
In the kitchen, I poured myself some wine. I rinsed the lettuce and made a dressing. I could hear Cass moving around upstairs. I wanted to go to her, but I felt I'd been instructed not to, told to wait. Finally, I heard her on the stairs. I rushed into the living room and met her as she emerged from the narrow stairwell. "Darling," I cried. She was thin. Her hair was nearly shaved, but her face was innocent and open in embarrassed pleasure, and she looked pretty. I held her. "Bones, bones! How mushy I must feel to her." We rocked together a moment. Then I felt her slight withdrawal. Quickly, I released her. "Let me see you. Let me see this incarnation," I said. She laughed and twirled around in a charming gesture, but a gesture, too, that let her move farther away from me. Her expression was still perfectly pleasant, but it had somehow closed up. She was much too thin, I saw now. Her jeans hung loosely off her hips and legs, bagged a little at her bottom. Her hair was bluish fuzz on her skull. She had an earring in one eyebrow and a semicircle of a dozen or so more arcing along the outer curve of one ear. She wore a tight orange top, leopard-dotted. Her breasts had gotten nearly flat. Her ribcage was clearly outlined. On her feet were thick, orthopedic-looking black boots. But she had smelled clean and soapy when I held her. Her eyes now were bright, and her skin, Daniel's pale skin, was clear and taut. "The hair is an adjustment for me, I have to say. But you look great."
"Well, I had to shave it," she made a face. "It was so fucked up from the last dye job that I had no choice."
She was wearing dark eye makeup, like coal all around her eyes. They looked, as my mother used to say, like two burned holes in a blanket. We went into the kitchen so I could heat up the chili and pour her some wine. She began to talk, pacing, sipping, finally sitting down at the table. The talk seemed pressured, as though she needed it, a miracle for silent, sullen Cass. I busied myself putting clean dishes away, wiping counters. I was fearful of coming too close, even of sitting opposite her, fearful of seeming to want more than she was giving, or of wanting anything at all, really. Cass made you careful.
"I've gotten, so I really hate it," she was saying. "Just the kind of stupid interactions, the way things have to get negotiated. You know, who has power over who, who's going to decide. But it's all such crap, like, decide where to spend the night. I mean, what are the options ever? We either have one place or none, and who cares? And it's like, once Stelly left..."
The other girl in the band.
"I was supposed to be like everyone's mother. They were always confiding things. Creepy things. Even Raimonda. Who wants to know?
I tell them, who wants to know stuff like the girl you once beat up, or the time you made it with a guy, or who followed you into the men's room and did what to you tonight after the show? Sometimes I thought she wanted me to probe. I could feel her eyes skidding over to me after she said something that might have shocked me, but I stayed quiet. I made the most non-committal of comments, or just mild noises. Olive oil on Prozac. So, I think this is it for me. We have like 6 gigs after Christmas all up and down the coast, and then I'm done with it. I bail. It suddenly occurred to me with a kind of yank of the heart, fear, pleasure, that she might be suggesting she'd like to live at home again. And then what will you do, you think? New York, she cried. I'm going to get famous, she laughed, and spit in all their eyes. Whose eyes, I wanted to ask. Why? But some part of me relaxed. My life with Daniel wouldn't have to change. And then I felt mean because of that. I was hoping she hadn't noticed my relief, but she was safely launched in another direction. See, I met this guy in Washington, and he handles models, sort of drug-looking models. Not like pretty girl stuff. I mean, it wasn't like he was coming on to me, but he said he was sure I could do it. I guess I have that certain sordid beauty they want. She posed, suddenly pouting, pushing her shoulders forward, elongating her arms, deadening her face. And I saw that she was like an ad I'd seen. For what? Underwear, maybe? Perfume? I wasn't sure. My hair should get kind of like a little longer, but no problem. It will be by then. And then, if I can just get some cash together, maybe Stelly and I can cut a demo or something. That's the big dream. The modeling, if that works out, is fine, but it's more like kind of a means to an end. So you got thin for that? She laughed roughly. I got thin, mother dear, because I haven't had enough food to eat, because I've stayed up too late doing naughty things. I could hear that she was pleased to be telling me this, pleased to introduce me to the harsh realities of her life. But that is why he offered me the job, so I dasn't fatten up much. We have to keep the home cooking scene here pretty minimal. We want those bones to stick right out there. She tapped her clavicles with her purple fingernails. When Daniel came home, I relaxed a bit. He was much easier with her, much more able to ask her things directly. I felt, though, that the version of her life she offered him was different from what she had wanted to show to me. With him, she talked about the music she'd written, the limitations of the band, what she thought she might be able to do with Stelly in New York. Once or twice, she alluded to something darker, but she didn't seem to have the desire to shock Daniel or to wound him with what was painful to hear about in her life, if that's what she'd wanted from me. Was it? I had never known with Cass, and the truth was, she probably didn't know either. When I was most confused by her, it helped me to remember myself at her age. Just that egocentric, just that lost, just that uncaring about the pain I might be causing others because I felt I was in so much pain myself. After supper, Daniel left and Cass helped me clean up. Then she asked to borrow my car. She wanted to go to the Sidecar, a bar 2 towns over that featured local bands. I just want to see what's happening, see if anyone I know is around. I won't be late. But Daniel was long home from his church group, and we were both in bed with the light out when she came in. I listened to her moving slowly through the living room, murmuring to the dogs as she made her way. Their paws clicked wildly on the floor in their dance of excitement. She stumbled on the first step up and said, "Shit!" clearly. The floorboards upstairs creaked and groaned and marked her progress until she'd gotten safely into bed. I relaxed then. I changed position. I spoke Daniel's name barely audibly. "I'm awake," he whispered back. "Reminds me of the bad old days, doesn't it?" Yes. Yes, it did. The times when one of the girls was out until dawn and we didn't know whether to call the police or not. The time when friends had brought Nora home so drunk
that she threw up before we could get her to the bathroom. The time when Sadie called from Hadley to say she'd wrecked the car and cut her forehead open. All the times when Daniel and I lay like this, side by side in the dark, unsure, unknowing, scared as children, while the children moved dangerously around in the world, learning to be adults. The next day, a half day of work for me, Cass offered to go get Sadie at school and to do the shopping I needed done on the way. Both girls came stumbling in with grocery bags just as dusk was falling, and the first few flakes of what was predicted to be a blizzard. They were noisy and cheerful, and their speed and energy and sheer volume reminded me of the happiest days of their adolescence. We had a light supper, chowder and cornbread, fruit for dessert. After dinner, I got the stuffing ready while Daniel and Sadie made two pies. Cass sat at the table with a glass of wine, disappearing outside occasionally to have a cigarette. We could see her through the kitchen windows under the falling snow, her breath itself as cloudy as smoke, her skull covered by a wool cap, her body huddled against the cold as she drew luxuriantly on the cigarette. When the pies were in the oven, we all moved to the living room. Cass played us a few of her own songs, gloomy and elliptical, but with complex, even lovely rhyme schemes. It was hard to get a sense of what they might sound like in performance. She kept interrupting herself to tell us what Stelly would be doing now. She's going like, ooh, ah, 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 or what the bass player would be up to. But when she finished, we all applauded, and she flushed and suddenly looked girlish and sweet. Sadie pulled two red tulips out of the pitcher on the table next to her and tossed them to Cassie, who stood to pick them up, pressed them dramatically, elegantly, to what there was of her bosom, and then suddenly curtsied to the floor, showing us fully the smooth, shadowy surface of the top of her head. Afterward, she played some tapes for us, tapes of her band and of a few others she knew. Standing by the tape deck after the first few songs, she started to sway in rhythm, tentatively, then assuredly. Sadie jumped up and joined her. Together, they moved around the room, as all three girls used to do occasionally in high school, each lost in a separate, wild response to the beat. Sadie's more a matter of bouncing, almost leaping up and down, her arms moving like wings, elbows in the lead. Cass doing a kind of step dance in her clunky boots. They both kept their eyes nearly closed in pleasure. They wore eager, rapacious smiles. They were showing us something, marking some difference between themselves and us with their loose, beautiful bodies, with their response to the music. I loved to watch them. But it made me sad, too. Both of them were pinked and glistening with sweat when Daniel and I met each other's eyes, and he announced in the break between two songs that we were going to walk the dogs and then go to bed. Cass ran to the tape deck and clicked it off. No, no, no! Let us do it! Sadie, look at the snow! She went to the window. We all got up and followed. Outside, the world had been transformed. All the particular shapes and structures of our yard gentled, humped. Each dark branch of the horse chestnut was outlined in white. The light post wore a jaunty, perfectly balanced cap of it. The snow still fell, slow, fat flakes in the windless air. We were silent a moment.
This is perfect, Sadie announced. Then, God, isn't it great? I have a holiday and we get snowed in. I ordered this, she cried.
I worry about Nora, I said to Daniel.
Don't.
It'll all be plowed by the time she starts out, he said, especially because it's Thanksgiving.
What time is she getting here? Cass asked.
I was standing right behind her. She smelled of wine and tobacco and bath oil, and faintly, too, of perspiration, a salty odor.
Noonie, she thought, I answered.
Noonie?
Sadie cried. She and Cass looked at each other and grinned.
Noonie? Sadie repeated. She said Noonie?
What's so funny about that?
It's the kind of thing you're always saying, Mom.
Cass began to sing, moving her splayed hands in stylized punctuation.
Noonie, by the way, it rhymes with Mooney. if you'd rather George Clooney, but Mom said it, Noonie.
I waved dismissively at them and headed for the bedroom. But I was feeling a kind of sweet delight at their amusement, an amusement Cass would never have indulged on her own. Maybe Sadie could show Cass a way to be occasionally affectionate about my foibles, my failures, instead of always angry. Just as I shut the bedroom door, I thought to yell at them, "And bundle up! You're all overheated and vulnerable!" They burst into laughter and drifted out to the kitchen. "Overheated and vulnerable," I heard Sadie repeating. When Daniel came to bed, I leaned over and bit his shoulder through his flannel pajamas.
"What for?"
he complained. "For being the old progenitor here." I love what we made. I love having them home. "Hmm," he said. Then he made his voice formal and raised a warning finger. "Let us see what the morrow brings."
"Oh, don't be a pill. You love it too, you know it."
"I do," he said. Just then there was a sharp rapping at the window. Daniel slid out of bed and pulled the shade up. The two of them stood under the falling snow, waving to us. Their hats were pulled down over their ears, across their foreheads, which rounded their faces and made them look like children again. Their cheeks glowed. Now they stepped forward and pressed their faces against the glass, smashing their noses flat and white, smearing their lips to one side, gooey monsters. Daniel feigned horror and quickly pulled the shade down again. We heard them laughing. A moment later, a snowball, then another and another hit the glass. Then their voices faded into the storm, and the dogs, excited barking, slowly moved away. Off and on through the night, I woke to the clanking passage of the ploughs nearby or furred through distance. Beyond that, there was only the cocooning silence of the thick snow surrounding the house. It was still falling heavily when I rose in the dark at 6:30. I'd offered to do the morning and suppertime shifts with the boarding animals. Ned and Mary Ellen would handle the rest. I ate a slice of toast while the car warmed up. It took me a while to clean its windows, and I had to rock it twice to get it out of the driveway. But the roads were scraped and sanded, and then salted too, once I got out on the two-lane highway. Our mall hadn't been ploughed yet, so I parked at its edge and trudged across it through the prairie of deep snow. The dogs heard me, opening the front door, and began to cry and bark, and when I turned the lights on, the din became general. The dogs we had for this long weekend all got along, except for a male husky German shepherd mix named Lucky. I left him in his cage for a while and released all the others. They milled around me like so many scattering pool balls, sniffing me and each other, and then moved loosely with me to the back door. When I opened it, they burst into the yard, a flood of seven happy dogs, more than usual because of the holiday, and began larking around. All but one, a fat old cairn named Watson. He stopped by my feet in the doorway, taking in the hostile transformation of the universe. The snow was deeper than he was tall. He turned and started to go back in. "Ah," I said. I picked up his tight, barrel-shaped body and carried him to the center of the yard, set him down where the snow was already dented from the bigger dog's play. As he circled to find the perfect spot, he picked each paw up and gave it the most delicate of shakes, a kind of rumba of fastidiousness. Finally, he did his business. Then he made a bounding yet dainty run, nearly like the hopping of a rabbit in the deep snow, back to the open door and in. I stood in the center of the yard for a moment and tilted my head back to let the soft snow touch my face. The dogs pranced and rolled for pure joy in the pale, gray-brown light. They chased each other wildly. I made snowballs and threw them. The dogs leapt and bit at where they disappeared. As they played, their muzzles whitened, their paws pilled up. I left them reluctantly and came back in. Watson trailed me around as I did my chores, watching me soberly. I shut him out of the cat room, where we had only two boarders. I let one of them out to roam and use the litter pan while I checked its cage. I put more food down. Then I went back out and worked my way through the dogs' cages. Two of the dogs had had accidents, so I cleaned up and changed their bedding. Several of them had had their own food in cans. Those dishes needed to be washed. Water refreshed, kibble set out for the others. I went to the cat room, put the first cat back and let the other one out. Then I called the reluctant dogs in. Watson greeted each one like a tiny worried mother, licking at their snow, fussing about how they smelled. Slowly, I recaged them. I released Lucky and let him go outside for his solitary run while I refilled his food and water dishes. Three dogs needed medications. I put the last cat back in, called Lucky inside, locked up. And while I did all this, I thought only of them, of the dogs and cats, of their requests for affection, of their comical or passionate relations to one another, of the performance of their bodily functions. I was taken up by them, and their life and energy, by what they needed and asked of me. I let go of everything difficult or complex in my life. It reminded me of my days at Dr. Moran's, caring for the dogs and cats he boarded and treated. It reminded me of what a comfort it had been to me, even just physically, the escape into the lives of the animals. As I was driving home, I thought of all this, and it seemed to me that I'd chosen work which offered me daily the presence of a pure innocence, a forgiveness for all my human flaws. It occurred to me suddenly that this, too, might be a kind of running away, a thought I dismissed quickly, or didn't dismiss exactly, but allowed to be subsumed in memories that came to me now, memories of what my earlier real running away had brought me. Dana, Lyman Street, Eli. Eli, who I'd see the next day. For we were having a party. We decided on it after Nora agreed to come home, in order to dilute what might be the intensity of the family weekend. It was Daniel's suggestion, and he'd offered to make several of his party dishes. A mammoth pork stew, roasted chicken wings. He'd also suggested I ask Eli and Jean. What he actually said was, "And why don't you ask Eli Mayhew, since you have such a flaming crush on him? And Sadie would like having his wife, I suppose." "Daniel, I don't have a crush on Eli," I said. "How can you say such a thing?" "Okay, you don't have a crush on him," he said, smiling. "Ask them, anyway." It was only later, a day or two later, after I'd thought about it and realized how often I'd spoken of Eli since I'd seen him again, that I acknowledged to Daniel that I did, in a certain way, as I put it, have a crush on Eli. And I started to explain the web of memory and loss and yearning I'd spun around Eli's arrival in my life. But he just grinned at me, and then laughed as I kept earnestly at it. Finally, I gave up, smacking him lightly several times on the butt as he danced away from me, crying out in mock pain. But here's what I thought. That if I had a crush, it was on an earlier Eli, one who didn't exist anymore, and the real Eli was just a vehicle for it. Or perhaps, even more complicated, that the crush, if you could call something so psychologically distorted by such a playful name, was on myself. Middle-aged Eli contained for me, of course, his youthful self, yes, but he contained me also, the self that had known him then, myself when young. And that was what made him attractive to me. You read or hear every now and then of a romance starting up between middle-aged or even elderly people who knew each other years earlier. People who throw over long-established, comfortable marriages or sensible lives for the chance to love again in a particular way. A way that connects them with who they used to be, with how it felt to be that person. And now, with Eli's arrival in my life, I could understand the potency of that connection. The self-intoxication you pass off to yourself as intoxication with someone else.
So, yes, I said to Daniel, I did. I had a crush on Eli Mayhew. And now I look forward to the party, to seeing him there. We'd ask the girls for names of their friends to invite, and so it would be a big gathering, 50 or 60 people, and it would include all ages, even some babies, the first of the children of Cass and Nora's friends. When I called to ask Eli and Jean, she'd answered the phone. I told her there would be a real cross-section of the population of Adams Mills, and she sounded delighted. I feel as though we've barely even had time to look around us so far, and we've met almost no one, so this is wonderful. How nice of you. After a pause, she said, what should I wear? And we both laughed. Now, driving home on this snowy morning, I wondered how it would go, how it would be to see Eli in a purely social context. Mentally, I'd rehearsed various conversations we might have. It seemed possible we would speak of the past. It seemed possible we might offer each other some new ways of thinking about the pain and confusion of that time, some new ways of understanding who each of us was then. And it also seemed possible, and more likely, I reminded myself, that we would make standard chatter, that Eli would become just another pleasant person I knew in Adams Mills. Daniel and Sadie were up when I came in. She was in her bathrobe at the table drinking coffee, a new habit for her, one that made her look older to my eyes, almost jaded. Daniel was peeling potatoes at the sink. Oh, she cried, cold air! She clutched her bathrobe around her throat. Shut the door! Shut the door! It is shut, darling. It's just a little atmosphere that's attached itself to me. Is it awful out? Daniel said. Not so much, actually. But the snow is really deep and heavy. Wet. Nora called, he said. She started. Well, the main road seemed fine. Tons of salt. She'll arrive, coated with it. But our yard, Daniel. I know. I'll get on it before she turns up. I kissed Sadie's head. Her smooth brown hair. She smelled of shampoo. How'd you sleep? Have enough covers up there?
I was snuggly. But Cassie, she snored like a big fat old man all night long. I could hear her even through the walls.
That must have made her particularly popular on those nights when they all slept together in the van.
God, the whole van probably vibrated.
What time will Nora get here, did she say? I asked Daniel. I moved over and stood next to him, watching his quick hands flick potato peels into the sink. He was still wearing his pajama top. His hair was wild. She thinks around one, unless there's some problem on the road. So you think dinner around two? Yeah, I should think so. She'll be starving. But we don't want to cut it too close, in case she's late. No, I suppose you're right.
Have you noticed, Sadie piped up in her baby voice, that when we're all home, half the conversation is logistics? Who's going where, what time, how, who'll drive like that?
Daniel turned to her and grinned. Half logistics, and the other half battles to the death.
Daniel,
I cried. God, what a depressing thought. And I went to change out of my scrubs. Of course, there was truth to his remark, and it was the reason he'd been reluctant to have all the girls home at once. Our holidays in particular had a history of disaster. Once, in childhood, upset about some slight, Cassie had run away Thanksgiving morning. We hadn't noticed she was gone for more than an hour, at which point Daniel started driving around looking for her, and I began to call friends. By noon, the turkey in the oven, Nora babysitting for Sadie.
Do I get paid for this?
Each of us was out in a separate car, cruising all the back roads slowly, stopping and hiking across the dry, pale brown meadows to any place she'd ever shown interest in. Bishop's Pond, the woods behind the Holt Estate, the old mill site, the playground behind the school. We'd agreed to meet every 45 minutes back at home, and I remember waiting for Daniel's car in the driveway, watching for the little bump of her head in the silhouette in the front seat, and never seeing it. Daniel, shaking his head as he got out of the car to confer with me.
his mouth bitten in a grim line. At 4, I came back early, certain any more looking was fruitless, and went to call the police. In Daniel's study, I thought, so Sadie and Nora wouldn't hear me and be frightened. And there was Cass, curled up asleep in his daybed, her thumb to her mouth, her face streaked with the dirty traces of tears. She'd been in the barn earlier, she said, when I woke her, but it got too cold, so she'd come in here.
"'Cause it reminded me of Daddy,
as though he were the one who'd run away. On another occasion, Sadie had decided she was a vegetarian, on moral grounds. No turkey for her, thank you, just stuffing and potatoes. These she doused liberally with gravy. After Sadie had almost cleared her plate, Cass leaned over and asked,
"Know what gravy is made of, dummy?"
"Cass, don't," I said, realizing only at this moment what we'd let Sadie do.
"No? What?" "Blood and gooey fat that's dripped down from your poor, innocent, slaughtered turkey-lurkey."
There was a silence.
"No, it's not," Sadie said.
Cass grinned even more widely.
"Is it, Mum?"
She turned to me.
"Cass," I said, "I could skin you alive."
Sadie shrieked and rose from the table.
"You made me! I hate you! You made me eat it!"
"Sweetie," I was saying, "we didn't notice."
I couldn't say we didn't care.
But she was running off now. Her chair went crashing against the wall as she spun away from it. You could hear her feet thudding on the stairs, her door slamming. First, Daniel went up to her, but she wouldn't let him in. Next, we made Cass go up and apologize. We could hear her raised voice. We could hear that there was no answer. When she came back down, Cass was smirking.
"She's got a big sign on the door now, and it says we're all murderers and sadists."
"Hmm," said Nora, theatrically thoughtful.
"I thought she was the only Sadie."
And they laughed together wickedly, twins again in meanness. Another time, it was Nora who refused to come to the table, refused to eat with Cass because she called Nora a hoe, and with us because we hadn't been willing to intervene. The charge had something complex to do with Nora's stealing a boy away from a friend of Cass's, and we couldn't follow any of it. Besides, we'd learned long since to stay out of the running conflicts between them.
"But a hoe, Mother, that's terrible."
"It's just a word from a rat record, Nora. No worse than lots of others. Can't you let it go?" But she took her plate and went up to her room, and we all ate downstairs in joyless silence. Near the end of the meal, Cass burst into tears and said,
"Just say it. You all hate me. You all wish I was the one who wasn't here and Nora was the one who was."
"Shoot me now, Daniel," I said when we went to bed that night. "Oh no, that would be too easy." We both laughed grimly. Nora arrived just before 1, looking elegant and arty in a chic way. All black, naturally. Bell-bottom slacks, and over them, a very short, tightly fitting jacket with a zip front, the silver tab outsized and industrial-looking. She had large silver earrings on, too, and her hair was pinned back with a silver clasp. She was slender but not thin. She had a bosom. The only resemblance to Cass initially seemed to lie in the similar, very clunky boots they both wore, though Nora's had a higher heel. She and Cass were sitting next to each other on the couch in the living room before we ate, and I kept coming in from the kitchen to look at them. Would I even have known they were twins if they were strangers to me? I suppose when you stopped and really compared their faces, it was clear. The long nose after me, Daniel's clear white skin, the dark brows and wide mouths. The lazy sensuality, the held-in quality that made them seem older than Sadie by more than the 5 years that separated them. But the differences between them, between how they'd arranged and treated what they started out with, were so profound that they seemed more than accidental, more than just where life had led them. Cass had been telling Nora about her plans, and now Nora, in a proprietorial tone, "It's my New York," began to offer to help her. Cass was more than gracious enough in response, I was glad to hear, talking with a calculated hesitance about the place she thought she might live in with Stelly, about the job she might be going to get. Nora had started in on what jerks those model agency guys were. What did Cassie know about him? She ought to check out his reputation. Nora had some friends in that world. She could get phone numbers for Cass to call and so on, when I called them to the table. Several times through the meal, I met Daniel's eye as we kept things rolling, innocently interesting along. Daniel was open and easy with them, and all three were easy with him, as they always had been. Even in arguments, they listened to Daniel, the fairest of us all, as Nora once called him. He asked questions now, lots of them, which was more acceptable to the twins than my doing so. That was probing, a no-no. Sadie's sweet enthusiasm about both their lives made them expansive and generous. Cass told funny, harrowing stories of the road. Nora talked about her film project, about money problems with it. Sadie and Cass had just begun to tease her about when she might marry Brian, when she announced she wasn't ever going to, that they were planning to stop living together in January. There was a serious turn after this, talk about relationships, trial periods. They were kind to one another, speaking of their failures, though they made fun of Sadie when she tried offering her high school love as an example of this. I mentioned my divorce as a disaster brought about by not letting couples at that time experiment with living together.
"I always forget you were married before, Mom," Sadie said.
"Me too," I answered, and Cass laughed appreciatively. They sent Daniel and me to the living room after the main course was over so they could clean up, and I felt some tension about leaving them alone together. But when I stepped in once to see how they were doing, there was a clatter of dishes, and then I heard Sadie say,
"Is it a famous recluse?"
And Nora answered,
"No, it's not Howard Hughes."
So I came back and leaned comfortably against Daniel in front of the fire. By the time we'd finished dessert, it was after 5. Sadie went upstairs to call some friends who would also be home for the first holiday since college had started. Cass picked up her guitar and began strumming in the living room. Nora went to her room to change, she said, but maybe just to be alone. Daniel and I worked in the kitchen on food for the next day's party, and then we sat at the table to sort out what our chores and duties would be. At 6:30, I drove over to the clinic to feed and exercise the animals again. The snow had stopped, though the plows were still working here and there. When I got back, there were extra cars parked in the plowed-out drive. I could hear the bass line of murmurous music and the sound of animated conversation pitched above it as soon as I got out of my car. Inside, I greeted them, Sadie's friends, and then withdrew to the kitchen. Cass came in and cut herself another piece of mince pie. She hunched at the kitchen sink to eat it from her hands.
"Watch it," I said. "You'll lose your skinny job," she made a face.
"Where's Daddy?" I asked.
"Out yonder,"
she tilted her head. "Are you going to retreat upstairs?"
"Nah. Nora and I thought we'd go over to the inn for a while."
She began to lick her fingers.
"Oh, nice," I said.
Could it happen? Had they been apart long enough? Had they grown far enough away from each other that they could be friends at last? I took a corkscrew, 2 glasses, and a bottle of wine through the snowy yard to Daniel's door.
"It is I called. "Let me in."
He was smiling as he opened the door.
"You couldn't take it either, could you?"
"It is noisy.
One day of togetherness, and you're hiding out here with me."
"Well, you're my pal.
Don't forget it."
There was a book on the daybed, Memory's Ghost. He moved it and we both sat down, propping ourselves in opposite corners, our legs stretched out, touching. I opened the bottle and poured the wine. We leaned forward to knock our glasses together before we drank.
"En garde," I said.
"What are we toasting?" he asked. Cass and Nora are going to the inn, I said, together. That's toastworthy, if anything ever was.
Ha!
He said as he leaned back again. Maybe now that it's too late, they'll get along famously.
It's not too late, I cried. It's never too late. What do you mean too late?
Too late for us. Fine for them. Great for them. But too late for us as a family. I sighed. You're right, damn you. I drank some wine and set my glass down. This is all pretending, isn't it? I made a wide sweep with my hand. We're not really a family anymore.
I wouldn't be so absolute.
He set his glass down too, frowning. His hand reached out, pushed my skirt up over my knee, and found bare flesh. His fingers were cool. He spoke gently. Why are you always so cataclysmic, Joe? First, it's never too late. Then the whole thing is false anyway. Slow down, sweetheart. I looked at him. Daniel. Daniel, master of the golden mean. Why not? Why not try it? No, you're right. I shifted slightly for comfort. But it is irretrievable, isn't it? It's just different, Joe. It's another thing with its own pleasures and pains.
But they're pleasures and pains that take me up less. They're in their lives. And it's all more remote from us. See, I miss it. I miss feeling in it with them. I want to feel used more. I used to feel useful.
You are useful. He squeezed my thigh.
To what? To whom?
To me, utterly. To your work, to your clients and your animals. You're necessary. You're being used all the time.
Then why don't I feel that? Why don't I feel better?
For an answer, he slid across and sat next to me. He kissed me slowly.
Let me make you feel better, he whispered. Let me use you.
I felt sorrowful still. I didn't want to make our sweet, comfortable love. But Daniel was willing, eager, to do all the work initially. He shifted off the daybed. Holding me at the waist, he moved me in two long slides so my hips were at its edge. He knelt on the floor then, between my legs, and pulled off my woolly knee socks with elaborate care, stroking my feet, my calves. I lay back, my head touching the wall, and watched him, his pale face intent on his task. He reached up under my skirt now and eased my underpants down. Gently, he kissed the inside of each knee, and then pushed them both back and up. I closed my eyes, swung my head to the side. I felt his hands slide down the inside of my thighs, his thumbs and fingertips fluttering, finding me, circling, entering me for moisture, and then circling more. The pressure was light but steady. And now he pressed his face to me, and I felt his tongue, too, and then I couldn't tell it, tongue from fingers. I felt his hands shift around under me again, cupping my bottom. He slid me a little more toward him, opened me wider still. I let my legs fall fully back. The openness was what thrilled me. That and his tongue licking me everywhere, and his fingers teasing me, coming into me. I tried to hold on to just this moment, to feel it and feel it, but I began to ride higher and higher as he played with me, and then I came, calling, with his face pressed against me, and behind my closed eyes, oddly, what I saw were field flowers, pale yellow, purple, devil's red, flowers as I bucked and held on to his hair, his ears. When I'd finally relaxed completely, when my breathing had begun to come back to me, I turned on my side and swung my legs up to make room for him. He climbed up next to me on the daybed. We lay facing each other. My breathing evened out completely. I heard the metallic ticking of the baseboard heater, the wind in the pines outside. Daniel had unfastened his pants at some point, dexterous man, and now I felt his hard, silky penis push against my legs. I reached down, lifting my leg to rest it on his hip, and helped him come into me. We lay there, nearly face to face, Daniel moving in me from time to time with a gentle, wet sound. His breath was warm in my ear. I said, and he answered me. Why is it like this? I asked him after a while. Like what? He asked, pulling himself back and then slowly pushing in again. What do you mean? Sex. It's gone for so long, not happening much or just routine. And then it comes thundering back. What's the alternative? He said now, and he moved deep two or three times in me. I said, I don't know. Always fantastic, always hot. He smiled. Hard to imagine. Now he drew back and came out of me. After a moment, I reached down to touch him where he rested, wet against my belly. I held him and stroked him slowly, and then faster, my arm finally aching in its awkward position between us. Just as I felt I couldn't do any more, he rose above me, turning me on my back, and entered me again, pumping harder, watching us where we were joined. He worked, his face deeply concentrated. Then suddenly, his head dropped back, and he cried out twice, three times. He slowed, and gradually, I felt him soften within me.